Good Tuesday. It's the NPR News Update for June 17th. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, what Target might want in a new leader. We'll likely hear a lot about Medtronic's deal to relocate its base to Ireland ahead of the fall elections. Minneapolis prepares for the world's best baseball players. Cities try to reduce their footprints on the land. And there is a time to dance. First, residents along the Minnesota-Canadian border are stacking thousands of sandbags to try to keep the rising waters of the Rainy River and Rainy Lake at bay. Dan Crocker reports.
The Rainy River west of International Falls has overtopped its banks and closed Highway 11 near the small town of Loman. Coochaching County Commissioner Brian McBride says at least one house has been abandoned.
I've lived here for 64 years, and I think maybe once I've seen the water about this high, but it's going to reach levels that we haven't seen in our lifetime.
McBride says hundreds of docks have been destroyed on Rainy and Cabotogama Lakes east of International Falls. He says volunteers have sandbagged about 40 homes along the south shore of Rainy Lake, where water levels are expected to continue to rise. The dam at International Falls is wide open to let as much water as possible through. Residents have stacked 70,000 sandbags so far to protect homes, with thousands more on the way. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
The Minnesota State Colleges and University System says it gave Chancellor Stephen Rosenstone a 3-year contract extension 8 months ago. Alex Friedrich has more.
The contract increased Rosenstone's base pay to $387,000 and increased his expense allowances by more than $43,000. Minsky's board chairman negotiated the contract, and it did not go before trustees for a formal vote. Minsky trustee Phil Krinke said a final review by the board may have been more transparent, but he said that sort of oversight is usually a technicality.
The reality is, does it change the outcome? And I would say 99.9% of the time, no.
House Higher Ed Committee Chairman Gene Pawlowski says the low-profile negotiations, while not illegal, don't pass the smell test. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A federal court has sided with St. Paul-based Hubbard Broadcasting in a legal dispute with DirecTV. Here's Curtis Gilbert.
The ruling will keep two Hubbard-owned channels, Ovation and Reels Channel, coming to DirecTV customers. The channels have only been around since 2006, but the judge's order was based on a contract the company signed 16 years ago when a Hubbard subsidiary merged with DirecTV. The agreement gave the Hubbard family the right to distribute up to 3 channels over the satellite system, provided the programming met a set of criteria. Last year, negotiations between the two companies broke down, and DirecTV threatened to pull the Reels channel off the air. The satellite provider argued the 16-year-old agreement was never intended to last for generations, but the court disagreed. Hubbard Broadcasting issued a statement saying it's pleased with the ruling and looks forward to moving ahead with negotiations. DirecTV is considering an appeal to, quote, address the ruling's errors. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
DFL Governor Mark Dayton is describing the Medtronic acquisition of the Ireland-based company Covidien as a good deal for the people of Minnesota. But some of his potential Republican rivals in this year's governor's race say it's anything but. They quickly tried to make the corporate transaction a campaign issue and an indictment of Minnesota's business tax climate. Tim Pugmire reports.
When Dayton first learned about the $43 billion deal, he said his main concern was for the 8,000 Medtronic employees in Minnesota. He said he was assured by company officials that they plan to keep their Minnesota operations and all existing jobs intact, with plans to hire more in the future.
From the perspective of Minnesota, from the perspective of, you know, a major employer here, keeping all the jobs that are here and promising to add over 1,000 additional jobs over the next 5 years, that aspect of it is very good for Minnesota.
Dayton said he was also assured that the company's decision to move the executive offices was based on federal tax issues, not state taxes. He said Medtronic's tax liability in Minnesota won't change. The governor explained that as a U.S. corporation, Medtronic has to pay federal tax on all its foreign profits, and as an Ireland-based corporation, it won't.
They maintain that frees up the money that would permit them to make, they've said, $10 billion of additional investments in the United States over the next decade. So, you know, I'm not a financial expert. I can't assess what the intricacies are of federal and other countries' tax policies, but my perspective is Minnesota, and Minnesota taxes are not an issue.
Dayton said he thinks the federal government should take a look at those tax policies, but he said that's the purview of Congress, not the governor. Still, some of the Republican candidates for governor are placing the blame squarely on Dayton. Businessman Scott Honor said he thinks Dayton is dangerously out of touch for not expressing greater concern about the deal.
And what's happening here is you're seeing a company make a decision for tax reasons to move its corporate headquarters out of the state. And when you look at our governor's policies on regulations and taxes, we're pushing companies the other way. Instead of creating an environment where companies want to come to Minnesota, we're creating an environment where they want to leave.
Another GOP candidate, former state representative Marty Seifert, said he thinks Medtronic made its move for several reasons, including the tax on medical devices that's part of the new federal health care law. However, in a conference call with investors about the acquisition, Medtronic's CEO did not mention the medical device tax. Seifert said he's also convinced that Minnesota's tax climate under Dayton was another factor.
I am running into business owners all the time, both small, medium, and large, and they're telling me we are making decisions based on Minnesota's very anti-competitive tax climate. He doesn't want to hear that as a governor, but that's the reality. Is there are a lot of companies that are making decisions every single day based upon a very uncompetitive tax environment that he has helped create, and now he doesn't want to take responsibility for it.
Asked about the comments, Dayton said it was proof that Seifert doesn't know what he's talking about. And later Monday, Dayton and the Department of Employment and Economic Development hailed the expansion plans of a much smaller medical device maker. They announced that Cardiovascular Systems Incorporated is getting $2.75 million in state subsidies to build a $30 million headquarters in New Brighton and to hire 205 new employees within 2 years.
Tim Pugmire at the state capitol. Target is looking for a new chief executive to replace the recently fired Greg Steinhoffel. Minnesota has a lot riding on this selection. Whoever is chosen will lead one of the state's largest employers, one with deep roots and a history of commitment to the state. But the new CEO will be charged with riding a ship that has been listing. As Martin Moylan reports, the question for Minnesota is whether the new CEO will represent a major departure for the company.
How much does Target matter?
Target reflects everything that Minneapolis stands for in St. Paul.
U.S. Bank CEO Richard Davis says the choice of a new CEO is very important for the region.
Target is in every fabric of our community. They're one of the biggest charitable givers, and I'm quite optimistic that based on the board and based on the opportunity for the Dayton legacy to be protected, that Target's going to find a great leader.
In the tradition of its Dayton family founders, Target has contributed 5% of its pre-tax profits to the communities the retailer serves. By next year, the company expects to have given a total of more than $1 billion to schools alone. The company employs about 31,000 people in Minnesota. Target and its predecessor, the Dayton Hudson Corporation, have always had a CEO with a Minnesota connection, and every one so far has come from within the company. John Wood is a CEO recruiter with Heidrick & Struggles of New York. He expects Minnesota connections, values, and tradition will weigh heavily in the selection of Target's new CEO.
To find somebody who will fit with the values not just of Target but of the community is another level of complexity. You need to get the right sentiment and sensibility in that job because it faces the community pretty prominently, especially in companies that are culture-rich and part of the community. Ideally, you find somebody inside.
The board that will make the decision has fewer people with strong Minnesota ties than 20 years ago. In 1994, the board that named Minneapolis native Bob Ulrich to the top job had a majority of directors that either lived in or came from Minnesota. Today, just 3 of 10 board members are Minnesota natives, and only one lives in the state. But Morningstar retail analyst Ken Perkins says leadership ability is more important than roots when it comes to choosing a CEO.
It really just comes down to overcoming big issues and managing the long-term strategy to get the company back on track. And so they may be willing to take a look elsewhere, but there may be internal candidates also that are equally strong.
The board that will make the choice is under the gun. Shareholders signaled considerable unhappiness with most of Target's directors at the company's annual meeting last week. 4 of 10 got less than 80% of the vote, including interim board chair Roxanne Austin. Experts say a tally below 80% signals serious discontent among investors. Only 3 got the usual 90% or more, but all were reelected. Amid flagging shareholder confidence, the Target board has to decide whether the best choice for CEO is someone from inside or outside the company, or even from outside retail altogether. Best Buy, for instance, turned to the hospitality world when it tapped Hubert Joly as CEO. Wood, the CEO headhunter, anticipates Target's board will stay inside the retail sector.
Retail's complex. It's a unique beast. Most likely they're going to find somebody within retail, if not from within Target.
But Wood warned several leading retailers are hunting for CEOs, so there'll be a battle for the top candidates. Some corporate governance experts say shareholder dissatisfaction with the company's board may discourage some candidates. Among the names floated as possible fits for Target are the heads of Macy's and J.Crew, former Target Vice Chairman Gerald Storch, and current Executive Vice President Kathy Tesha. But Edward Jones retail analyst Brian Yarbrough figures Wall Street would like to see an outsider, especially one who can improve Target's e-commerce efforts.
Someone that's got a successful track record more than anything. I don't, know if they're going out looking for someone that's been, in retail for 25 or 30 years, because retail has changed so much in the last 8 or 10 years.
Target isn't saying when it hopes to have a new CEO. Whoever it turns out to be will be in a position to push major changes in Target's operations, including its relationship with Minnesota.
Marty Moylan for us on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minneapolis welcomes the Major League Baseball All-Star Game next month. Twins officials are expecting a sellout at Target Field, though the team has not officially declared the game between fan favorites from the National League and the American League a sellout. Fans already have seen ticket prices in the hundreds of dollars, and that's not the only thing that's changed since the All-Star Game was in town decades ago. Peter Cox has more.
The last time baseball's All-Star Game was in Minnesota, Pete Rose was still playing baseball. The Metrodome was brand new, and it cost $2 to watch the Home Run Derby. That was in 1985.
The All-Star Game itself has grown leaps and bounds since 85. Not only the game itself, but all of the ancillary events that happen in and around the Twin Cities.
That's Twins spokesman Kevin Smith. The Twins promise a 4-day extravaganza of baseball. There's a celebrity softball game, a player parade, and of course, the Home Run Derby, now a major television spectacle. All those events add up to a steep ticket price, leaving some fans unhappy. On her way into a Twins game earlier this month, Tammy Sly of Minneapolis said she's not ready to shell out hundreds of dollars to go to the All-Star Game.
I don't like it. It's not fair. It should be for the fans. I mean, we paid for the stadium as taxpayers, and we should get to go to the game.
According to a letter sent to Twin season ticket holders, the package of the game plus events started at around $400 and went as high as $1,400. Whether they're season ticket holders or not, fans have to buy the whole package, known as a ticket strip. Season ticket holder Dan Herrera of Roseville paid $420. Sitting at Hubert's Sports Bar before a recent game, he says it's worth it to see the best players in baseball and plans to go to all the events.
It's just exciting that it's, here in person, never seen it, and who knows if I'll ever have the chance of going again in my lifetime.
30 years ago, state officials expected 30,000 out-of-town visitors who would spend between $15 and $18 million. This year, Minneapolis expects the All-Star Game events to give the city a $75 million economic boost and bring in some 160,000 out-of-town visitors. Bar manager Zach Burns expects to see some of them in Hubert's.
And we're the closest place to the ballpark, so we're expecting to see a good chunk of those people. Every time there's an event, we've got a full building, so we're definitely hoping to see a little bit of extra money from that.
While nearby businesses should earn big, Victor Matheson says businesses outside the downtown core won't see much benefit.
There's no doubt that there's probably going to be $75 million of activity that does occur because of the All-Star Game. What has to be considered, though, is the economic activity that doesn't occur.
Matheson is a professor of economics at the College of Holy Cross. He researches the economic impact of major sports events. He says much of the economic activity during the All-Star Game week will actually just replace what would have gone on anyway.
And it means that you don't have new economic activity being generated. You just kind of have economic activity being shifted around and where it's spent in the economy.
But, Matheson says, it's not all about money.
Although we don't have a lot of evidence that events like these have a big boost to the economy, we do have some evidence that they actually make people happy. So, the All-Star Game should be a fun event for Minneapolis, and it very well may make people happy, but Minnesota shouldn't expect to get rich off of it.
All-Star Game events kick off on July 11th. The All-Star Game will be played July 15th. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Many Minnesota cities are trying to reduce their impact on the environment. Dozens are signed up for a voluntary program through the state that helps them identify ways to be greener, such as improving recycling rates. And now some of those cities are part of a program that helps track data ranging from water and energy use to greenhouse gas emissions. It's called the Regional Indicators Initiative, and it aims to help cities figure out exactly what's working. Elizabeth Dunbar has more.
Let's say I want to reduce my own impact on the environment. Should I recycle more? Save energy by blow-drying my hair less? Take light rail instead of driving? I could choose to do all of these things, but with some of them, there are trade-offs. So the key is knowing exactly how much energy I'll save or emissions I'll avoid with each lifestyle choice. Cities are in a similar situation. They're recycling a wider variety of plastics and replacing old light bulbs with energy-efficient LEDs, and they're promoting alternatives to driving alone. 22 cities representing a quarter of Minnesota's population are turning to data through the Regional Indicators Initiative. It's a project funded by the state and the Urban Land Institute of Minnesota.
It says, all right, we have these best practices. Now, are they actually making a difference in your community, in your neighborhood? Can we measure?
Peter Lindstrom is mayor of Falcon Heights. This Twin Cities suburb of 5,000 installed solar panels on City Hall and signed up for a discount program that makes solar panels more affordable for homeowners. Lindstrom says the city is also proud of its community garden and a new biking and walking path along Fairview Avenue.
I think the worst thing that any city can do is greenwashing, to say that you're actually making a difference but then not making a difference at all. Through the Regional Indicators Initiative, it's going to tell us whether our programs are making a difference.
The project has data from 2008 onward. Data include vehicle miles traveled, waste generation, water use, and the amount of electricity, natural gas, and other fuel being used by everyone within city limits. The cities that signed up had to agree to make the data public. Rick Carter has been managing the project. He's an architect at the Minneapolis firm LHB.
And that kind of goes towards the idea that you can't manage what you don't measure. If somebody's not looking at the data, it doesn't matter that you have it. And if everybody's looking at the data, it's better.
Carter says that could lead to a little friendly competition among cities. Studies have shown that it can work for homeowners. If your electricity bill shows how you're doing in comparison to your neighbors, it'll motivate you to use a little less next month.
You naturally use less because we're all a little bit naturally competitive and because you know. So the question about whether that scales up to a city remains to be seen.
One reason you probably won't see an all-out greenhouse gas war between cities is their emissions are highly dependent on what kinds of activities are going on within their borders. Some cities have factories and skyscrapers. Others are mostly residential. Some are dense, and others still have farmland. Carissa Shively-Slaughterback studies topics like sustainable development and land use planning at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School. She says doing city-to-city comparisons is a real challenge.
You really have to understand the individual community context, what's going on there, what are the generators of those greenhouse gas impacts, and then what are the tools that we have to actually affect the kinds of activities and generators that are going on there.
But Shively Slaughterback says cities have proven to be a good place to tackle the greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change. It's where most people live and work, and in a lot of cases, saving energy means saving money. It's now up to the cities to take several years of data and decide what new policies or actions will help them reach the next level of being green.
It's not easy being green, but that is Elizabeth Dunbar for us. Now, for the rest of the podcast, All Things Considered host Tom Cran introduces You in Care.
To dancer and choreographer Emily Johnson, movement is everything.
And to me, dance is happening all the time in the world, every moment, whether it's the movement in the trees or the blood in our bodies, you know. And so I just try to frame performances having that already very broad view.
Johnson and her internationally acclaimed Minnesota company, Catalyst Dance, will underline her belief over the next week with a new piece called Shore. You in Care reports it is an epic work spread over several days.
Many dancers pride themselves on making their work look effortless. Not so for Emily Johnson and Catalyst Dance. At a rehearsal in a South Minneapolis studio, Johnson and her fellow dancers' feet pound the floor as they rehearse. Johnson grunts as she hurls herself through the steps. The finished piece will include music, but on this afternoon, it's all about the movement. The dance constantly switches pace and style. Classical ballet moves slide into steps from a Native American grass dance, and then primal gestures the dancers develop for the piece. There are moments of frenetic activity, leaving them gasping for breath. These are balanced with moments of complete stillness. The piece has been almost 2 years in the making, and Johnson says dance is only one element.
Shore is equal parts story, performance, volunteerism, and feast. And it's really all about gathering. So we gather in those different ways. We gather to work, we gather to listen to stories, we gather to eat, and we gather to experience performance.
Johnson draws on her experiences growing up in a Native Alaskan community for Shore. Her family still gathers to harvest, fish, and hunt, and then to preserve the food for the long Alaskan winters. It's a time to tell stories, laugh, and argue.
I love those moments of gathering that really are work and story and future and food. I guess that's what I'm trying to make.
The performance begins tomorrow night, not with dance, but a reading. Local writers will tell stories about the area at the Loft in Minneapolis. Johnson always tries to link her work to the land. Another element in the piece is a cleanup on the shores of the Mississippi. Volunteers will pick up trash, hear stories, and eat snacks at River Flats Park in Minneapolis. The dance performances on Friday and Saturday will begin outdoors on the Northrop Mall at the U of M with 20 dancers. The performance will then move inside to the huge stage of the auditorium. There, Johnson and just two other dancers will perform the bulk of the piece. The prospect of three performers on such an enormous stage delights Johnson and director Ian Gordon.
It's huge, and we've made it as big as possible by
taking all the soft goods out. It's a stripped bare stage, so
out
of the pit, as big as that stage can be, is how big we've made it.
The performance of Shore wraps up Sunday with a feast at a farm in Osceola, Wisconsin. It's free, but everyone is asked to bring a dish to share, which has special meaning to them. Johnson's work is known for attracting both hardcore dance fans and dance newbies. Shore is also perfect for the reinvention underway at the Northrop Auditorium. Formerly just a performance venue, it's now home to several academic programs. Johnson is a fellow at the U of M's Institute of Advanced Studies, housed in Northrop. Director Chris Chita says the aim is to develop more connections between what's happening on the Northrop main stage with the academic life at the U.
Whether that will mean more master classes, more extended residencies by artists when they're here, more of a connection with the students to the process of the work being performed on stage. I mean, we will look for ways for that to develop.
After its Northrop appearance, Shore goes on a national tour. But don't ask Johnson about that yet. With a reading, performance, a cleanup, and a feast to coordinate, she laughs she'll focus on the tour next week. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. That's it for a Tuesday. Come back tomorrow for all of the Wednesday news. And if you care to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Picardi MPR, at PICARDIMPR.